This is the second cassette from the Thursday, May 11, 1995 interview, side A, which makes it the third cassette overall in the Howard Lee interview.
So when the dust, so when the dust cleared in 1984, the Democratic Party had lost once again. As the dust cleared in 1984, we Democrats had not only lost the governor's office again, we did not gain back the Senate seat, which was the greatest, most devastating, in my opinion, campaign loss. And we had barely won the lieutenant governor's office again. And we had lost at a congressional seat, which we never thought would go Republican in the 4th district, that the seat that I had contested Ike Andrews for in the Democratic primary. So for the Democrats in 1984, it was a devastating year. Add to that the problem that the Jim Hunt organization, which I mentioned to you, had grown to be the supreme, most powerful Democratic voice, was now very devastated in that it had lost a campaign and had no incentive to go forward to do anything else. And the Democratic Party was at its all-time weakest position and was broke. So I am convinced that the demise of the Democratic Party really seriously had the great blow in 1984.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Let me ask a few more questions to, so we can elaborate on this a little. Your perspective on the Hunt-Helms race, most expensive in history, clearly a huge and hotly contested race.
The Jim Hunt-Jesse Helms race changed politics in North Carolina forever. It changed the way campaigns would be run. It brought into North Carolina politics for the first time the personal attack ads. It raised the stake of how much money people would be willing to spend on campaigns. And it gave a tremendous boost to the Republican Party. And it also created an organization called the Congressional Club, which was the Jesse Helms organization, that would take over and start having successes in with winning candidates in North Carolina, purely because it had masterminded the successful campaign against the Democrats' most powerful leader in 1984. So North Carolina politics has not been the same, and for the first time in races that came after the 1984 race, local elections began to show signs of introducing the same kind of tactics and techniques in campaign. Also, the 84 race, the Jim Hunt, because of the losses in 84, the legislature now became the supreme body, which it and gained a position of visibility the legislature had never enjoyed before. So now it was the lieutenant governor and the Speaker of the House who were the key Democratic leaders in the state of North Carolina and became the Democratic stars in the state of North Carolina, and the Democratic Speaker, of course, was a fellow by the name of Liston Ramsey, and the Lieutenant Governor was a fellow by the name of Bob Jordan. Liston Ramsey represented the more conservative wing, and he didn't feel any strong identification with the party, even though he and I had worked closely in 1972 to bring about party reorganization. And Bob Jordan was the leader for the Democratic Party, and he was a little more moderate than Liston, and trying to gain confidence of the conservatives. Being a businessman, of course, that gave him some inside track. So all of those things, it seems to me, grew out of the interactive campaign between Jesse Helms and Jim Hunt. And I think there's no doubt that that race rippled effect in every aspect of politics in North Carolina, and that we would go on and experience the fallout from that campaign for years to come.
Mm-hmm. Can you describe your 1984 congressional race?
My 1984 congressional race began because the year before, Ike Andrews, as the Democratic nominee who was in Congress at that time, had been arrested for drunk driving a few days before the general election in 1982. And we had, some people had gone to Ike and told him that this really should be his last time, and we all rallied around Ike Andrews and got him reelected in spite of that devastating problem. I had been convinced that I should run for Congress in 1984. I discussed this with the governor, who said he thought it was a good idea, that Ike Andrews needed to come out of Congress, and therefore he, the governor, would give me his full support, even though he was a candidate for the U.S. Senate. On that basis, I submitted myself as a candidate in 1984 for Congress, only to have Ike Andrews change his mind and decide that he really wanted to run again. And that put me in a terrible position because I had put together an organization and, of course, should have probably removed myself from the race when Ike Andrews came in, but I really thought I could beat Andrews. But I had we had mutual friends. For example, Coach Dean Smith, who has been a very strong supporter of mine through the years, had a sister who was on Ike Andrews' staff, which created tremendous conflict for him. The governor, who had promised to give me his full support and make available resources, decided that it was not his best interest to do that, so he withdrew. In addition, some calculating Ike Andrews supporters got together and decided that they had to come up with a way to diminish my impact. So they went out and found the son of a very prominent black political leader in Raleigh by the name of Winters. The man's name, and the man who had had a long and admirable political history's name, is John Winters. His son's name is John Winters Jr. But they put him on the campaign trail and put him in the campaign, even though he'd never run for public office before. But they didn't use John Winters Jr., they used the name John Winters. So now you've got the names of two prominent black candidates on the ballot, John Winters of Raleigh and Howard Lee of Chapel Hill. Raleigh, having the most votes and being most familiar with John, felt that I was running against John Winters Sr. And John Winters Sr. was a part of the calculated move to bring this about. So it wasn't so much a matter of splitting the vote as creating psychological doubt in the minds of people that even many of my white supporters would say, but there are two blacks in the race and two blacks can't win against one white. And they would cast their vote for Andrews because they, for whatever reason, it was a psychological move more than anything else. I was on the way to winning that race until late. Then it went into a where we thought it would be a runoff. And then Ike Andrews ended up beating me by, I think, it was a very small margin. The margin was so thin that had I gotten all the votes that went to John Winters, I would have been the nominee. Mm-hmm. So I lost that campaign, and I lost it pretty much on that basis. Mm-hmm.
Happening in the early 80s is reapportionment and the what will ultimately sort of play out as the Jingles case, the voting rights case at the state level in North Carolina.
Yes.
Leslie Winter will bring the case out of the Chambers firm, Julius Chambers firm down in Charlotte.
Yes.
Do you have recollections about that issue? And
well, certainly there was a great push during that time for a different kind of structure for ensuring a fairness of vote. I have never been very supportive of many of these movements, but I have certainly understood and been sympathetic with the basis for the movements. It's unfortunate that blacks have been denied full participation in the political process for such a long time, to the extent that there was a feeling that there needed to be special districts created for to ensure this. Now, I've never really thought that was a reality, that there needed to be special districts. I've really thought that there needed to be special efforts made to ensure that ethnic minorities gained within a broad-based structure, even if the numbers didn't say that they could pull this off. And I felt that we had come into a different environment than what we had been conditioned to expect. In the civil rights movement, we had shown patience, but we could see some immediate results. I mean, you could go out, you could bang people, you could sit in, and you can get immediate results. In the political arena, there is no immediacy. And I tried to get people to understand that it's a long process. You not only have to be vigilant, but you have to be patient. There wasn't much patience. And so I began to get a little bit concerned because there was strong talk about single-member districts. And single-member districts would ensure that women and minorities and everybody would have some representation. My concerns even back that far was that single-member districts would create an increased number of Republicans. The Jingles case, without a doubt, put North Carolina on notice and created a mentality that would come to bear in its full realization with all of its negatives in the early 90s. It took 10 years, but it happened, and it almost happened exactly as I had told people I thought it would happen in the final result. So beginning in the early 80s, you did have some changes in voting districts that created an increased number of minorities in the legislature. And with that increased number of minorities in the legislature, you had the stage set for increased influence of those minorities in the legislature along with women. And so finally, you had to know that eventually, if those folk maintain their own mindset of being in supportive of the concept of the Jingles case of reapportionment and redistricting and ensuring that district lines were drawn in a way to ensure fair and equitable minority representation, that it had to come back to haunt in some way. My position on that had been, what is the ultimate goal? And Jingles was a the principles in the Jingles case were very much involved in my 1976 campaign, so I had to be very careful. I mean, these are supporters of mine, and I certainly didn't want to go against them. But my question always has been that, what good is a politician who cannot influence other political sources? And if you create a district or reapportion in such a way that you've got all your minorities over in one area. So I think the Jingles case, without a doubt, brought to the forefront the question of fair and equitable redistricting and bringing about a more, what people conceive to be, greater opportunity for ensuring access by people of various geographic and ethnical groups.
Mm-hmm. Did you have the view that the various moves following Jingles, well, sort of in the Jingles sustained, would almost as a matter of inevitability lead to these kinds of changes? Did you, because clearly most minority political leadership would have been supportive in an overt and direct way of the Jingles litigation.
Yes. I think there's no question that the Jingles case had a positive bearing on minority presence gains across the board, local as well as state. The question that I have asked is, where does the ultimate trade-off lead? What it did is, for example, in the legislature, that was an increased gain, and Leslie Winter was very much involved with the Black Caucus that was very small at the time. Had people like Dan Blue in there and a few others, and later came Toby Fitch and some of the other people, but had enough of a voice that it could be at the table, and it could put proposals on the table and could vote on those proposals. Now, it had to make some gains because the Democratic majority in the legislature recognized the importance of the Black vote, so it had to make some impact. In that regard, that there is no question that one could look at Jingles with a very positive attitude and say, without it, we may not have had those changes. I'm not sure that's true, because my feelings then, as they are now, is that anytime you isolate a weak group, though that weak group may gain, it gains symbolically but not substantively. And so that weak group then, in the long run, becomes even weaker. If you accept the premise that most people will respond from a self-interest position, and most politicians do. So if you've isolated the Black votes from voting from any white candidate, and all they can do is vote for a Black candidate, then that white candidate has no real reason, except as you can present some other reason for him or her to have an interest to support conceptually what it is that group is talking about. So all that group gets to do then is to raise the red flags. Now, early on, the interest was maintaining an active Black vote. But as that vote declined through the years, and it turned out that many of those, quote, legislators were not representing all views of all Blacks, then it ultimately resulted in a different kind of outcome. And that's my concern, is that if one just takes an isolated look at Jingles and say, boy, we gained on that, it'll give you a feel-good position, but it doesn't give you a gain.
Well, the GOP itself anticipated this in some respects.
Absolutely.
Because they were supporters of this sort of litigation.
Everything the GOP did from the early 1980s was designed to isolate minorities from the Democratic Party. And we can talk about that as we go along, but everything they did. And in many instances, they were smart enough to make it appear as if it was in the interest of the minorities. And none of what the GOP did, in my opinion, was designed to be in the interest of the minorities. Now, I don't say that in a negative way. I give them credit for being smart enough to outmaneuver the Democratic Party, which was so smug in its own level of security at one point, and then so weak at another point, that it didn't have the ability to respond. The Democratic Party by the 1980s, the Democratic Party had become a victim of the visible Black, I like to call them. They had become the victim of the Jesse Jacksons, who were running around threatening to do certain things. The Democratic Party had become the victim of the legislative Black caucus. The Democratic Party had become the victim of the loudmouths. And the Democratic Party had to embrace such people as Marion Barry. So it was appearing to be so Black that it was while it was promoting the Barbara Jordans up front, it wasn't doing very much to enhance the substantive group down below. So the gap that we talked about earlier was getting wider and wider. And these blacks, like many white politicians, always portrayed themselves in a dishonest fashion. They would portray themselves as having greater influence than they really had. Gullible white leaders who didn't want to deal with the masses always accepted them because it was easier to deal with these folk than to go out and deal with the masses. And so the Democratic Party was kind of like an animal feeding on itself. It was destroying itself. And the GOP was very much like a cunning animal that had discerned what was going on, and it was pouncing on it with every step. And for the next 10 years, you could see this occurring. Mm-hmm. I sometimes look back and don't know why I didn't go Republican. Because had I gone Republican, I could be whatever I wanted to be today. As a matter of fact, the Republicans most recently approached me and said, if you'll join our party, you can run for any position you want except governor or U.S. Senate this year. Next year, you can run for U.S. Senate. And I have no real reason except there is something inside of me that makes me believe that I should not take actions that are designed specifically to enhance me. If I could justify in my mind that there is a need for me to ensure that the Republican Party approach issues in a broad perspective manner, and that I approach the Republican Party the same way I did trying to position myself in the Democratic Party, then I might consider it. If it appears to me that the Democratic Party will continue to go down and the Republican Party will continue to rise, at some point you have to decide that the Titanic is not worth saving and you need to get on the lifeboat and sail out to sea for the big ship. These are obviously questions that have to be dealt with. People have often said, well, how can you be in the same party with Jesse Helms? My response to that, the same way I was in the same party with Sam Ervin. Senator Sam Ervin fought every civil rights bill that came along. And if I can tolerate being in the same party with Sam Ervin and George Wallace, what's so distasteful about being in the same party with Jesse Helms?
Mm-hmm. How do you think black political leadership in North Carolina more widely is breaking on this issue that you've just said yourself now are considering?
I think it's a widespread process. There is no more unified black vote. And some people will say, well, that's the death of blacks. I disagree wholeheartedly. There is no unified, monolithic black vote anymore. It is unified where there is philosophical camaraderie. But I think what we will see from this point on is that we are on the early edges of a new renaissance, that blacks who are conservative are now willing to openly admit they are conservative. Blacks who have identified with the Republican Party are now willing to openly say, I'm a Republican, period. And blacks don't subscribe any longer to just supporting social programs because it will help the poor and the poor black. Blacks today are more discriminating in their views to be able to recognize that society didn't send these blacks to prison. They sent themselves to prison because of their own behavior. And they came out of an environment where a lot of people who came out of that environment didn't go to prison. That there is no justification for letting black women, females, keep having babies and black daddies run around and not support those babies. There's no longer justification for that. And so blacks are demanding that we stop pitting people on the basis of race and judge people on the basis of responsibility and irresponsibility. And so the identification with that kind of change in philosophy, the unwillingness to have Jesse Jackson get up and say it's our duty to support the unwed mother, blacks are saying, you're full of it. That's not true at all. It is our duty to say to that unwed mother that you have an obligation to get off your tail and not keep having babies, develop some skills, get out, go to work, and ultimately support yourself. And so you're going to see more and more of that, whereas that's been identified as racist in the past. It is no longer acceptable. Mm-hmm. I happened to be recently looking at a TV show, and this black woman was on the show justifying why she had to go in and steal from department stores, and she described it as a survival thing, and that unless you've been black, you can't understand it. And blacks in the audience attacked her 100%, saying, you're full of it. You're absolutely, you're a crook. You are dishonest. You're untrustworthy. And I frankly wouldn't want you living next door to me. That would not have happened a few years ago. Mm-hmm. So as that kind of philosophy that is espoused by the Republicans, like I, as a graduate student in the mid-60s, was writing papers on the need to reform the welfare system. So what the Republicans are proposing about reformation of the welfare system is not in disagreement with my own views about what I felt needed to be done for a long time. Where Democrats went wrong is Democrats didn't deal with it because they felt they would alienate certain black leaders. And they were right at the time. Because these black leaders were saying to other blacks, if you not for welfare, then you are against your brother and your sister. And then these same black leaders will stand up and say, you know, we have a big job ahead of us. We've got to work with those. One out of every four black males are going to prison, and these are victims of society. Well, you know, my response to that has always been three out of every four black males don't go to prison. Now, you tell me why I need to be concerned about the one instead of spending my resources and more time enhancing the three. Mm-hmm. And so blacks are not buying that anymore. Mm-hmm. And when Clarence Thomas was confirmed as a Supreme Court justice who did not walk the conventional black philosophical line, it sent one of the most powerful, most rippling messages the nation has known since slavery. It changed everything blacks felt. And so I think you'll see more and more of that. Mm-hmm. And that probably may be a problem for the Democratic Party coming mm-hmm. back.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk about the specifics of the changes leading up to the early 90s and emergence of this sort of view you've just been describing. And in particular, the development of a certain type of Dan Blue's role, and mm-hmm. he probably wouldn't be identified with that sort of perspective so much. But how about, can you describe for me, you were not yourself in Raleigh active as an elected official across most of the 80s, well, across the 80s. Of course, you went into the state Senate in 1990 until just recently. But can you describe sort of Liston Ramsey's tenure and the, in 88, with sufficient GOP wins at the state house level, they now, really for the first time in the state house, political power has to be shared. Ultimately, Ramsey is displaced in a bit of a coup, and finally then thereafter, Dan Blue is made Speaker of the House. So your perspective on that?
Well, I certainly think one, again, has to go back to the Jingles case and recognize that the gains by the GOP were made possible by reapportionment actions that ultimately did take place. As I recall, in the early 80s, the legislature had to take several cracks before they finally got redistricting to a point of being acceptable. Now, as we all know, the Republicans were coming into power at the national level at that time, and so they were watching this with great interest. But gains were being made in the state house among Republicans at that time. Excuse me, the alienation of, let me restate that. There were new people who brought in maverick attitudes being elected to the House of Representatives. Keep in mind, I'd mentioned how weak the Democratic Party had become. Very few candidates were running on anything that reaped of any similarity to a Democratic Party platform. They were running on their own agenda, period. And if you had gone across the state and watched every race, that's what they were doing. But at this time, the Republicans were starting to run on an agenda. A party agenda, and they were espousing the same line. You could talk to any Republican anywhere in the state of North Carolina and you'd get the same line. You could talk to any Democrat and you would know what they were talking about. So you had Republicans coming into the state house and you had these maverick Democrats coming in the state house. They didn't know how to play the game or were not willing to play the game. Liston Ramsey came out of the old school, which said you run the political arena with an iron hand and you toe the party line and you ask no questions. These guys were shunted to the back row and they had a lot of time to sit back there and seethe. And they seethed. And Liston wouldn't, because they questioned on the floor, because they voted what they felt individualistically, and because they challenged him in committee, and because they publicly went out and made statements that he found unacceptable. They didn't get any choice committee appointments. They were given no chairman positions, and they were given the trash committee assignments, and they were given the worst seats in the chamber. So Joe Maveretic was among those. Joe Maveretic did not think he could unseat Liston Ramsey, and neither did anybody else. So Joe Maveretic decided, party doesn't mean anything to me, and I'm going to put together a coalition, and he did it by making promises to Republicans. Republicans, again, saw this as a tremendous opportunity. They weren't going to get anything anyway. If they supported Maveretic, they might get access, at least. And they also felt that they needed to break up the old system. And this started in the 1988 election. It all built up to 1988. As the Republicans were getting elected, the maverick Democrats were getting elected. And Bob Jordan, against everybody's advice, had decided to give up the lieutenant governor's office and to challenge Jim Marden, which was a mistake. Of course, everybody knows that now, but even then, some of us said to Bob, you can't beat Marden. That let Jim Gardner in the door. And the unfortunate aspect of this whole situation is that loyalty among blacks kept them with Liston Ramsey. Now, granted, Liston had been very good to including blacks in his administration, so it was not just idle loyalty. It was out of one black voted away, a fellow by the name of C.R. Edwards, who is currently serving in the state senate, broke and voted for Maveretic. And the other blacks crucified him to the point that he decided the very next year to leave the House of Representatives because he was absolutely isolated by other blacks. So Edwards left, and that again was the beginning of other blacks felt that the black caucus had treated Edwards badly and that they didn't respect the individuality of blacks. So there was great debates now occurring. And this, I think, for North Carolina was the first time when black leadership, so-called leadership in the legislature, was taken to task. And this pretty well was the last straw up to this point for the Democratic Party. It was the nail that went in the coffin.
Mm-hmm.
And so the Democratic Party has been struggling since 1988 to get out of the coffin. Because you see, it was after 1988, the Democratic Party was leaderless. It had no elected official who was in the position to be the head of the Democratic Party. No Speaker of the House, no Lieutenant Governor, no, as I recall, Terry Sanford was still U.S. Senator or that whole, but he was in Washington, so he wasn't here. There was nobody. So the leader of the Democratic Party then became the party chair. And the Republicans grew because they had everybody who was influenced, who could do things for people in the leadership role. And that's when the wholesale switching started to occur from Democrat to Republican in North Carolina.
Tell me about Dan Blue.
Dan Blue cut his teeth in my 1976 Lieutenant Governor campaign. He was a young lawyer out of school working for the Terry Sanford firm at the time. And as a result of his organizational efforts, both with the party and through my campaign in 76, ultimately became a member of the House. Dan Blue is a very skilled politician. Dan Blue, in my opinion, was ready to be Speaker when he took on the position. What many people don't know is that in 1988, I believe, or 1989, there was an effort to convince Dan to challenge Liston. Dan was really first recruited to challenge Liston before even Maverick. And Dan chose not to do it. At the time, I was not there, and from a distance, I did kind of question whether or not that was the right thing to do. I thought he probably should have jumped in on that. But in hindsight, I think he was exactly right. So it would appear that it was natural that he would have Liston's good graces in 1990 and would go ahead and become Speaker of the House. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, what, 1989 or whatever it was, and would go on and become Speaker of the House.
Can you describe, sort of in this context, your state Senate, your involvement as state senator after 1990?
I had been giving some thought of running for lieutenant governor. I'm getting my dates confused, but I'd been giving some thought to getting back into politics in the late 80s and early 90s. Actually, late 80s is when I'd really thought about getting back into politics. And I was having breakfast one morning at the Pancake House in Raleigh, and happened to pick up the News and Observer to find that one of the senators, a lady by the name of Wanda Hunt, was going into the Martin administration and was thinking of resigning her Senate seat. And that hit me because in 1989, and I had really been giving serious consideration to running for U.S. Senate, and Harvey Gantt and I were jockeying over who would be the candidate, not feeling that two blacks should run. And Harvey and I met in Greensboro in late 1989, and he misrepresented to me at that time that he had more money in the bank to run the campaign than he ultimately had, and I really hadn't started raising money. But I never closed the door on the possibilities of running for U.S. Senate against Senator Hams or seeking to be the Democratic nominee until I saw this article about Wanda Hunt's resigning. And within the next 2 weeks, I had traveled to each of the counties in this district and had locked up the votes outside of Orange County. Unfortunately, Margaret Pollard decided that she wanted to challenge, and I ended up losing the two votes from Orange County for my bid for state Senate. Fortunately, I had locked up the votes in Randolph County and in Moore County.
These are votes just for the tape.
These are votes out of the counties, out of the Democratic Party. Each county is given a percentage of voting power. Mm-hmm. Randolph County and Moore County together had greater voting power than Orange County and Chatham County together. Because I had locked up the votes in Randolph and Moore County, I was able to get the nomination or get the appointment to complete the unexpired term of Wanda Hunt in the state Senate, being appointed in 1990, and then running for re-election in 1992. Mm-hmm. Actually running for re-election in 1990, and then, of course, 1992 for re-election again. But I was disappointed that I had lost the two votes from Orange County. I still find it comical that the two ladies who had the votes here in Orange County felt so strongly about a woman being in that they would be willing to give up a seat to another county. Fortunately, I won. I ran for re-election. Again, I was not sure how I would take to being a member of the legislative body. I'd always been a single person making decisions. But amazingly, going back into the state Senate, I was associated with a lot of people with whom I'd been associated through the years. Many members of the Senate had been people I'd gone out and campaigned for. When I was Secretary of Natural Resources, I had done things for them in that district. And the president pro tempore of the Senate at that time, Henson Bonds, was a very close friend of mine, and he and I had worked on a number of common projects. And I had even made available some funds for a park that was ultimately named in his honor. Henson allowed me to become an immediate integral part of the operations of the Senate behind the scenes. And that prepared me for going back in and growing to be a very influential person in the Senate for the next two terms. I was able to get legislation through that nobody ever dreamed would get through. There had been a 10-year effort, for example, to remove the stature which did not allow school systems to eliminate corporal punishment from its disciplinary practices. And I was able to get that legislation through both houses to the amazement of a lot of people. The state had always been very resistant to any kind of budget flexibility, allowing local entities to have the ability to transfer monies across lines. Mm-hmm. I was able to get that through for the university system. The university had been trying to get appropriations for a building for the School of Social Work here for years and had been in and out of the budget several times, and I was able to get $9.5 million in for that. And a long list of successes which even amazed me that I was able to get through. And ultimately, again, I hate to put it on the basis of race, but because blacks had not been in the position, my last term, I was rated the 9th most effective senator out of 50, which had never been accomplished by any black in either house up to that point, to my knowledge. And would have, if I had been reelected in 1994, would have become the black ever to be a chair of Appropriations Committee and would have been Appropriations Committee chair. Mm-hmm. But that was not to be, and history was not to be made on that. But as a member of the Senate, I think without a doubt, again, I was able to represent symbolically how far we have come in accomplishments. My whole political history has not been based on running and being elected from a dominant black voting population. I've always run and been elected from a minority black voting population, which I think is very much in line with how I want to be viewed and how I think we should strive. I believe that it is incumbent upon minorities, blacks, women, and any other ethnic minority, to work harder than most candidates to gain the confidence of the majority of voters. and not be so concerned about whether the voting bloc is of their similar ethnic group or their gender group or whatever, but whether or not philosophically there is a connection. And so it seems to me that when we reach that point, then we can have a political system that doesn't make decisions based on uncontrollable factors that are impacted on people, but is based more on what is good for the ultimate masses of people. Mm-hmm. And I think my whole image and political life represents, beyond a shadow of a doubt, that it is possible for that to happen. Mm-hmm. And it's not a fluke. People could have said, well, Chapel Hill is liberal, and so you got to be elected mayor because you came out of a liberal Chapel Hill. But the 16th senatorial district cannot be viewed as liberal by any stretch of the imagination.
Can you give me your perspectives on the Harvey Gantt's emergence on the state political scene and his race against Helms in 90?
Harvey, of course, had been a good mayor of Charlotte, to my to what I know about Harvey. I like Harvey as a person, but Harvey has the reputation and sometimes gives the impression of being a little bit arrogant. And that's how he's often described to me by people who've come in contact with him. Whether that is ultimately Harvey's beliefs or feelings, or whether it's just a quirk of his personality, I think is anybody's guess. But he had lost the mayor's race in Charlotte when everybody expected him to win. So I think people were anxious to see what Harvey was made out of. And so when he came into the race against Helms, I think most people viewed Harvey as most people would have viewed me, is that he, first of all, didn't have a chance to come out of the primary. And when he won the primary, it was such a refreshing change that and such a positive, at which I had related to its ability to give a more positive image with Jesse Helms. And again, people didn't think Harvey had much of a chance at beating Helms. And as the campaign progressed, obviously it appeared that Harvey had a real crack at it. I was disappointed with the way in which Harvey ran the campaign. I felt that he was absolutely wrong following the Dukakis line of pronouncing himself as a liberal. And it, I think, indicated how little, what little appreciation he had about the state in which he was running. He made a number of miscalculations. When Bush vetoed a voting rights piece of civil rights legislation, Harvey had no business jumping on that. My position with him and to his people were that if people don't know where he stands on civil rights, then they don't need to know. And so he doesn't need to go pronounce that from the mountaintop. And he handed Jesse Helms the very thing that he, Helms, needed to build on in order to take Harvey down. It didn't diminish Harvey's support. What that did was to enhance Jesse Helms' voters. Those people who may not have worried about going to the polls because they didn't think old Jesse was beatable, now were told this thing might happen. And if it happens, here's what can happen to you. We're now ready to drive those pickup trucks to the poll, hang those guns in the racks on the back window and go in and vote. Mm-hmm. And I think Harvey basically sent the death knell himself. Harvey didn't listen to a lot of people. He closed his campaign off. A lot of the longtime conservatives tried to talk to Harvey. Moderates like Terry Sanford tried to convince him that he needed to be less talkative and more active. He had an awful lot of people with him, and he had more money than he could ever anticipate using, which is a first for a black in this state and a first for many candidates too. So I don't think he ran the best campaign, and I was somewhat disappointed in the manner in which he projected himself as a candidate. He did not, and I watched a number of the television debates, even as someone who knew him, he didn't ever seem to be able to connect beyond the television screen. He didn't seem to ever be talking to the voter out there. He always appeared to have a kind of static line that he was going to present, and he just presented that line with no feeling and with no emotion. Jesse always presented himself in kind of a common, no rehearsed kind of manner, and obviously there was some connection. The other thing that Harvey did not calculate, and anybody who runs against Jesse Hams needs to do that, is that people generally don't make their decisions based so much on what your positions are on the issue as much as what you can do for them. And Jesse Hams has this reputation, whether he agrees or disagrees, of servicing his constituency. And that was never addressed in the Gantt campaign, which is the strongest point, in my opinion, that Jesse Hams has going for him. Anyone can write Jesse, including me, and get a response. Mm-hmm. Jesse Hams is a gentleman. I don't care where I see the man. He's going to treat me with respect. He's going to be warm, and he's going to chat. And he's a gentleman. I don't agree with him, but I respect him. And I think that's what Harvey couldn't generate. And I'm not even sure that some of the candidates who are now talking about running against him, including Harvey, will be able to generate. I'm very much unimpressed with the candidate pool. And, of course, I've been approached again about running again, but I don't feel like getting in a $6 million campaign at this stage of my life. But I think Harvey's candidacy, without a doubt, generated a new feeling and rekindle an excitement within among black voters that had not been felt for quite a long time. Mm-hmm. There was an awful lot of emotional attachment in the black community. But in the end, it also created a lot more doubt. The thing that disappoints me most about Harvey, all the things that I've said, is that after the campaign, he disappeared. And he didn't relate or understand that he had taken the black voter up here to almost to the mountaintop, and it almost happened, and then he walked away. He left them at the mountaintop. He didn't ease them back down. He didn't walk with them back down the mountain to say to them, look, we had a good crack at it. We almost scaled it. We're going to do it again. He didn't stay in touch with them to help them nurse their wounds and to heal their hurt. He just left. And for the last 5 years, very few people have seen or heard anything for Harvey Gantt. And my opinion is he does not deserve another crack at running for anything, because a candidate should not be that insensitive to people who invested as much as blacks and whites, but certainly the black community invested in trying to get him elected. Mm-hmm,
mm-hmm. What's your sense of how the 96 Democratic primary will shape up?
I suspect if the mix stays as it is right now, that Harvey has the best crack at being the candidate. I think there are other people who could enter that race that would knock Harvey out. I have talked to a number of people who have indicated to me that they are disappointed for the reasons I've stated to you, especially the aftermath of the campaign behavior. And on the other hand, though, Charlie Saunders, who's a very nice man to get to know, is a doctor. He's a chief executive officer, and he's not a candidate. And I went to a reception for him recently, and it was almost like dealing with a statue. And I like Charlie, but he says nothing that excites me. So if it's just the two of them, unless Saunders wants to spend a lot of money and not go out and shake hands and use the television to get elected, and I'm not sure that'll work, Harvey probably will be nominated. I think if Harvey is nominated based on the fact that he's already proclaimed himself a liberal, And based on the fact that some of the same issues that took him down before are still there, and based on the fact that we're in a much more conservative posture in North Carolina than we ever have been, and based on the fact that all these races are on and the GOPs are riding high, I think Harvey Gantt will be the greatest anchor on the Democratic Party in 96 than anyone has ever been in the history of this party. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Because I think what it will do is he will become the rallying point, and then the Helmses and the gubernatorial candidates and everybody will use that to rally around Harvey Gantt.
Mm-hmm. What's your sense of the relatively recent Helms split with the Congressional Club?
I don't think it means anything. Historically, the Congressional Club came into being because of Jesse Helms. The Congressional Club did not make Jesse Helms. Jesse Helms made the Congressional Club, and it's kind of like a parent splitting away from the child. The child's name and reputation or image is based on the parent's name and reputation. And I think what's happened more than anything else is the Congressional Club has lost its glow and will be very ineffective. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I'm just looking over my list of last matters we might discuss. We haven't talked expressly about a couple specific issues that arose, and this would be reaching back just a bit on the cultural landscape, if you will, the landscape of cultural politics, namely the busing issue, which takes us all the way back to Swann in 71. The emergence, say, of conservative Christian politics and the Moral Majority, for example, and more recent manifestations of that same type of movement. And although it hasn't been, well, there was additionally, in the context of school desegregation at the level of universities, the UNC-HEW fight through the 70s under Bill Friday. And then more recently, late 80s, the dispute over the King holiday. And a more modest issue as it's played out in North Carolina politics, I guess, has been the whole question mm-hmm. of gay rights. Mm-hmm. So,
well, we may need to schedule another session.
Can you give me a quick sense and we'll finish with maybe those things and then finally your concluding thoughts, matters we haven't touched on?
Okay. You want to
cover off? Sure. Maybe busing the Swann decision, your recollections about.
I can't remember all of the details except to respond conceptually to mm-hmm. the busing question as we know it played out in its most visible form in Charlotte. There has always been confusion within the black community on the busing question, and politically it has caused real problems for the Democratic Party because of that. Somehow we have had represented to us that integration in and of itself was the basis upon better educational opportunity. We missed the point, in my opinion. It wasn't integration that was going to make the case for better educational opportunity. It has always been the reapportionment or the appropriations of resources. And my feelings are that the whole question of moving kids out of their communities, whether it's the black community or the white community, for the purpose of achieving desegregation, was a detrimental act, and it continues to have detrimental effects on the educational experiences of children and on the effectiveness of our school systems. Why do I say that? Because we all recognize that one of the strengths of public school system has been feelings of ownership, identification with, relationships that develop among teachers and parents and leadership within the school and the community itself. And if your child is moved across town to another school, not only do you lose identification with the school that is accessible, you also have no identification with the new environment. So it's a matter of the kid going to the school, but no involvement. So busing, it seems to me, broke down the school community relationships. And that has had an impact on the parent teacher relationship. And the kid has fallen through the crack, and it probably has hit harder on the very community that it was designed to help, and that's the black community. Because here you have people who are already stretched in terms of time, the ability to get to school, to understand what's going on in the life of their children, And then when they understand that they need help to interpret it because they themselves are not that educated, have none of that. And the child is certainly not volunteering to include the parent in a lot of the negative things in his or her life. I frankly think we missed the boat on that one.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. How about the emergence, say, of the moral majority and a Christian evangelical character to Republican politics?
Well, I certainly think the Republicans took a page out of the history of blacks. And they recognized that one of the strongest institutions within the black community was the church. Whites, on the other hand, never tended to rely on the church for its political strength or any guidance through the political thickets. But as the Democrats were drawn more and more into these, quote, religious hotline, hot button issues, gay rights and abortion questions and equal rights amendment, these are things that Republicans were portraying as
you need to get that?
No. Rain came out on the
door. That'll be okay. Okay. We'll let it go.
As these hot button issues began to come more and more to the front, they, I think, brought to the mind of certain people that there is a group of people already assembled in the church. And as white religious leaders began to speak out on these issues, as black religious leaders had spoken out on the issues, they simply, it seems to me, recognized we're on to something good here. And politicians who can spot these things probably quicker than the hawk can spot prey jumped right on and started forging relationships with these folk. And again, I think more than anything else, the Republican Party was free to go after these folk. The Democratic Party and its political candidates were enslaved. They were not able to go after these folk. Why? Because the Civil Liberties Union was saying, you got to separate church and state. Who are the big portions of the constituents of the Democratic Party? Civil Libertarians. The Democratic Party had to stand for many of these issues because the people were involved in the party. And since the Republican Party had no vested interest, it could just let it all hang out. The Democratic Party had to take a position which was going against this group of people. And the more the Democratic Party did that out of its own survival, the more the Republican Party pounced on it out of its own growth.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. What are your recollections of the UNC-HEW fight?
I've always thought that UNC miscalculated on that one. I think there's no question that HEW was trying to make a point during those early years to establish itself more and more in the life of educational institutions. I often felt that HEW was not considering some of the pressures that had to be dealt with in the environment, in the context with where UNC was. And I frankly think HEW was coming after UNC because of some of the problems it had had earlier. It certainly had not been one of the more progressive in going out and recruiting faculty. It had certainly not been one of the most progressive in admitting blacks. Because UNC has never had to recruit. It has always had to select. And so it was in a terrible bind. Now, every time you select a minority, you've got to reject a white. And that was causing problems. So I'm not offering these up as excuses. these are factors that HEW didn't care about. Mm-hmm. And so it just kept pushing and pushing and pushing, and it put Dr. Friday and the leadership of the university at that time in a position where it was trying to maneuver itself quietly through the thicket toward some satisfaction and resolution of the problem. And the more it did it, less willingness HEW was demonstrated to give it time. And it didn't help matters that Julius Chambers resigned in protest. And that was Julius's style at the time, being a member of the NAACP. I suspect he felt caught too, because nationally people were saying, how can you sit there and tolerate this? And you're a member of the Board of Governors, and you're giving tacit approval to it. So Julius was resigning out of protest, but that gave more fuel to the fire. And I think it reached a point to where it just became emotional. And at this point, it was a digging in of an institution against a large federal institution of saying, by golly, we're just not going to do it. It did send a bad message out and divided the constituencies in the state. And I think we were very fortunate to survive it. And certainly that's one that's behind us. I was caught during those years because I was mayor of Chapel Hill and very active politically around the state, as you well know. And I was often called to task and found myself in a very uncomfortable position of having to defend the university's position and having to defend Bill Friday. Someone who has been and still is a very personal friend, and trying to represent a view that was not always viewed in the most positive terms out there. But I think that whole process probably created a rapid growth experience for the university that might not have otherwise occurred, though I disagree with some of the tactics that HEW employed during that time. Mm-hmm.
Do you want to share your thoughts on the effort to establish the King holiday here in North Carolina?
That certainly was a tough road to hoe. Again, we are in a state where people didn't think highly of the civil rights movement, and certainly didn't think very highly of Dr. King. Here is one indication, it seems to me, where a couple of variables came into play. Certainly, the Democratic Party felt the need to give support to that that effort because of the number of blacks who were continuing to vote for the Democrats. And secondly, the number of blacks serving in the legislature was increasing to the extent that there could be enough horse trading inside to convince enough people. But I think the King holiday establishing the King holiday was a success because of another factor. That factor is that practically every legislator in the General Assembly ran in a district where a sizable number of its voters were black. If we could overlay the most recent redistricting to the early 1980s and have the blacks in one district and the white in one district, I think the King holiday would go down to defeat if that were the case. But self-interest motivated many white legislators who did catch a lot of flack from many of their white supporters, and some were defeated over it, as a matter of fact. But because they had such sizable black voters, they were able to make the vote and to go forward. The King holiday was symbolic. My position on that has always been certainly Dr. King deserves some kind of monument to the efforts and sacrifices he made. I frankly did not want another holiday. It was just going to be another day for people to go out and have fun and go to the beach and play and so forth. It's happened pretty much that way, even though I am impressed with the number of educational ceremonies that do take place on the holiday. That, in my opinion, probably did more to enhance the feelings and security and positive feelings of blacks in the state than any other single act, to my knowledge.
So you've seen it in that sense as a
positive move, and I think even today, you'll find that most people who may have even been opposed to it during that time are accepting of it. Now, it's totally not totally accepted, but then what holiday is totally accepted and celebrated by everybody?
But lastly, at least on the things that I'll raise, and then I'll give you a chance to add anything that you'd like, the issue of Republican fiscal conservatism and it's being joined so closely, say, with the question of affirmative action and nominal sort of unfettered competitive job selection.
Well, I certainly think the two are in some way tied together. My feelings through all of this have always been that we were taking stair steps, but that we would not arrive on the plane of success until we ultimately get through the thicket of dealing with the question of economic disbursement, jobs, money, access, the whole question. Because everything we have done up to this point has been blocked by lack of resources to even consider gaining access when even the doors are open. I've often joked with many of my friends in country clubs who had these crazy policies that no minority would be admitted. And my position to them was, you don't need the policy. You've already got the barrier. That's the initiation fee. And so I think that that's what we're talking about. The people often say to me that, well, we're still not integrated as a society. And the reason we're not basically integrated as a society is that there is no access. And the reason there is no access is because of lack of resources. So when the Republicans talk about not dealing in the question of quotas, they are partly right and partly wrong. They are partly right in that the Democrats did play games and have played games with affirmative action. The legislation guaranteeing access is on the books, and then the pressure is turned up on the corporations or the job sources, and the job sources feel so much pressure that they hire mediocre people, and then those mediocre people don't perform. And whites who are on the job, who may have been even denied access, see that mediocrity and then begin to question why they're being denied when people can't compete, even when they're given a guarantee of competitiveness. Mm-hmm. So the Republicans are right in that affirmative action does need to be relooked at. I have also been a victim of affirmative action in that I have gone out to bid on certain contracts and have lost the contract because there was an incompetent black who was fronting for a group of white investors. So it works both ways. However, we do need some kind of legislation on the books that guarantees access. And that's all affirmative action should do. It should not guarantee success. It should not guarantee accomplishment. It should only guarantee access. And if get me in the arena, and if I can't compete successfully in the arena, then there's a question, going back to what I said earlier about being elected to public office. If I can't deal with that extra burden I'm carrying to the extent that I can be successful, then I have a question of whether or not, even if I'm in there, I will ultimately be successful. I have friends who talk about, well, affirmative action only levels the playing floor. And my response to that is that nothing levels the playing floor. And we shouldn't even waste time worrying about whether the playing floor is level. We should spend our time trying to become the best players on the floor, whatever it is, because everybody's playing on an unlimited, unlevel playing floor. How can I say a black who's raised in poverty is much worse off than a white raised in poverty? How can I say an uneducated black is worse off than an uneducated white? it does not make sense to me that we would create any program that caters to race, because if it works for me, it will also work against me. It's a government that if it does things for you, it can do things to you. The more it can do for you, the more it can do to you. And so affirmative action needs to be looked at in that light. Democrats have always been physically and economically conservative. Democrats, it seems to me, have always tried to create an environment of competitiveness.
Republicans or Democrats?
Democrats. And what Republicans have done is to take a page from the Democratic book and have done it better than Democrats, because Republicans need issues to run on. Democrats haven't felt we needed issues to run on. Republicans have felt they had to be street fighters. We Democrats have never felt we had to be street fighters. We had to fight among ourselves, but we didn't have to fight in the street. So Republicans have become very efficient at taking issues we have created, things we have done well, things we have done responsibly, and then turning them around on us and saying, but we can do it better, and here's what we can do. And so they hit the hot buttons. They hit quota. Democrats have been talking about the need to eliminate quotas for years. We talk about redistricting. We started the redistricting, reapportionments in the 80s. Reagan was coming into power. Republicans were taking over the Justice Department. By the time we got to the 90s, it was the Republican Justice Department who's saying, you guys have been unfair to blacks all these years. Now, what you need to do is to give blacks their own district so they can have somebody in Congress, so they can have greater people. What they would figured out is, again, get the black vote from the Democratic Party, move it over here, isolate it unto itself, and then we'll have access to all of these other people over here. And Democrats didn't see it coming. Mm-hmm. Whereas if Democrats years ago, and I argued even in 1990 legislature, why are we making such an effort to destroy Republicans by gerrymandering districts to be in our favor? What you do comes back around, so when you do it so you don't end up being a victim of your own doing. And now Democrats are a victim of their own doing. We are victims of our own doing in affirmative action. We are victims of our own lack of doing economically. We put things in the budget that had no business being in the budget and should have been debated, because we tried to satisfy every constituent with something for everybody in the budget. And now we're going to be a victim of our own redistricting, because it looks like Republicans may be in charge by the time we get to the year 2000, and they will gerrymander. So I suspect that what we're looking at here is that the Republicans will push this affirmative action, anti-affirmative action move until they actually become in control. And my guess is that if enough blacks have then transferred to the Republican Party, which will happen, that you will begin to see the Republicans moderate their views on affirmative action, as they're already showing signs to do, and begin to respond in some of the same ways the Democrats responded before them.
Are there issues we haven't discussed that
I think we've really covered the waterfront, but as you go through it, if you find things, just call me and I'll make time to do more. But I think we've done real well, Joe.
Yeah, I appreciate it. Thanks very much.
I'm glad to do it.
It's a real pleasure.
Thank you.